I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about preserving some of Indiana's most precious resources. We're going to talk about conservation and why it matters. My guests will be Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, John Shuey, Indiana's Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy, and Tom Holman of Indiana Native Plant and Wildflower Society. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about conservation in Indiana today. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests today are Cliff Chapman, who is Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, John Shuey, who's Indiana Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy, and Tom Holman, who's with NPAWS, that's Indiana Native Plant and Wildflower Society. Welcome, all of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. I want to start this conversation probably, conservation, try saying conversation and conservation in a hurry and you get screwed up. Conservation is one of those terms people throw around without being particularly precise about what they mean. So I want to start, so that we've got a starting point here, with defining what we're talking about when we talk about conservation. Cliff, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. Thanks, John. To me, conservation is looking at the natural resources that we have out there in Indiana and kind of seeing what the best is that's left and protecting them for future generations. At the Central Indiana Land Trust, we're not trying to save every single acre of land that's out there, but identifying the most important, the best, the sites with the most biodiversity and beauty, and protect those so that way future generations can enjoy them.
Out of curiosity, how do you define beauty?
Well, that's a different show.
Well, beauty in terms of I'm assuming, because I'm guessing that your resources are not limitless here.
Right, right.
That there have to be some criteria by which you say biodiversity, I understand. But when you threw in beauty, I thought, okay, what are we talking about there?
Sure. And to me, I am really passionate about Indiana and Central Indiana. And to me, Indiana has a real subtle beauty. You know, when you go out west, the western United States with the national parks, it's very dramatic. Monument Valley in Utah, it's dramatic beauty. It's in-your-face beauty. But Indiana, you have to slow down a little bit. Get out in the forest. Get out in the prairies and the wetlands. And there is incredible beauty, whether it be wildflowers or beetles, butterflies, birds. It surrounds us.
Tom, how do you define conservation?
Well, I'd probably start by defining it similar to what Cliff did, but I'd go beyond a little bit to say it's not just protecting the best of the natural areas. I'm all in favor of that too, but also protecting what's closer to you, bringing it into your cities and your neighborhoods, and bringing a little bit of that in there so that you can enjoy it on a more regular basis. Most of us don't have the time to really get out into the natural areas as much as we'd like to, so it's nice having some trees and native plants and butterflies and things closer to where we can commune with that a little bit and take advantage of that.
Okay. John, I'm going to give you the last crack, definition.
Sure, and just to build on what Jeff and Cliff have said, you know, the Conservancy thinks about conservation in terms of continuity, and it's not just the natural areas that exist and are set aside. It's the ability to maintain them into the future. And, you know, sometimes that involves moving them into public ownership as state parks or fish and wildlife areas. Sometimes it's working with the private sector simply to create those cultural incentives that make people want to take care of the land so that, you know, every acre doesn't have to be in public ownership if people actually value what they own.
What are, Tom, what are the challenges confronting us in terms of conservation?
Well, the challenges, I think, are trying to, mainly what building on what Cliff said, protect those areas, because we're going to continue to grow and develop areas, and that by nature is going to involve cutting down some trees and cutting some of that down. So, like Cliff said, we want to try to protect the best areas. But then, again, we want to try to save some portions of that and bring it into our own neighborhoods and stuff, too, and try to make this really a conservation ethic in Indiana.
Well, let's make I want to get back to that challenges question, but we probably ought to talk about why this matters. I mean, why is it important to do this work of preservation? Cliff, I'm going to throw that one to you.
You know, I think, as Tom was saying, we know that here in Indiana we're going to continue to grow, we're going to continue to build more houses, and we're trying to attract new businesses and create new jobs. And conservation of our natural resources is really an important part of that. You know, we don't have mountains, we don't have beaches or oceans here in Indiana, but we have incredible landscapes. And by conserving the best that's left, I think will be very important to retain and attract young professionals and people to come here with their families to not only get a job but have a beautiful place to go and enjoy close to where they work. So, taking a beautiful hike doesn't mean jumping on a plane and going somewhere else. You can do it right here in central Indiana and, of course, throughout the state.
We are talking about conservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI. Well, John, I'm going to ask a variation of that same question. Why is conservation important? Because, and I'm right now, what I'm hearing is that there is a spiritual component, that you can enjoy this and that it brings you in tune with your surroundings and your state in a way. I want some argument that's going to that is going to balance or to some degree offset the economic development argument that says, you know, well, by using this land in this way, by knocking these trees down, by doing this, we can make money, we can create jobs, we can do all of these other things.
Sure. Cliff hit on one of the issues. And, you know, Indiana spent a lot of time worrying about brain drain from the state. And it's a quality of life issue that people that are young professionals that can work anywhere they want to choose to work where, you know, in environments that offer them high quality of life. And the environment is one of those issues. So, you know, it's something that contributes in that way. It gives people a reason to consider Indiana home. But if we think, you know, just about what the environment does for us on a daily basis, you can't overlook the fact that it protects the water quality of essentially Indiana's drinking water, clean air, all those services we take for granted, and that we don't put a financial value on. It's really important not to overlook those. And just last week, there was a study published in the Proceedings in the National Academy of Science that looked at areas where there were ozone non-attainment areas across the United States, and specifically identified Indianapolis as one of the most cost-effective strategies for clearing up those ozone problems is reforestation around cities, essentially. And Indiana, you know, could benefit from that. And when you think about a big tree planting operation in central Indiana, you get so much more than ozone reductions. You end up with cleaner water, recreational opportunities, all those things that reforestation can bring.
Tom, how well does Indiana stack up in terms of you know, preserving, conserving its natural resources?
That's...
Or Cliff, anyone wants to jump in. Cliff, why don't
you? Sure. You know, if you look at the way the United States was settled, and the Western United States has a lot more public land and a lot more green space than the East, it's because the government, both federal and state, kept a lot of land, where in Indiana, as we were settled, immigrants that were coming from other parts of the world were given 160 acres or, you know, another 40 acres at a time if they cleared it to make the land more useful. So we kind of start off with a lot less than a lot of the United States. And one of the catches is, for us to really get some new momentum to move forward, we're still slipping behind now because other states like Arkansas and Missouri have been doing a phenomenal job lately by getting some dedicated funding to conserve more land, more natural areas. And Indiana has yet to be able to do that.
So by dedicated fund, what do you mean in terms of how are they doing it and how are they paying for it?
Well, sure. Every state does it a little differently. And in Indiana, the legislature has the opportunity or the governor to put some shots of money in every 2 years or so. And right now we have an amazing program that Governor Daniels set up called the Bicentennial Nature Trust. But it's a one-shot of money. And we have the Indiana Heritage Trust with the environmental license plates that I have on my car. But it's a very small amount of money that gets voted on every 2 years. In states like Arkansas and Missouri, they've been able to, and frankly Michigan to our north, there's different strategies. It's either a fraction of a cent of a sales tax or a bottle return or something that's more permanent. It's dedicated funding that's coming in every year that doesn't take a new vote and a political process.
And are there other states that have best practices that we might be able to emulate, John?
Certainly. Missouri has done a great job over the years of funding conservation, in part because they viewed it as a statewide priority from a quality of life standpoint and invested heavily in it. Whereas in Indiana, we kind of see the opposite happening every year with it seems like budgetary constraints or our government's asked to cut 5% almost every year. And so we see funding actually going down. And it's important to remember that Indiana and our adjacent states to the east and west, Ohio and Illinois, only have about 3-4% of their land base in public ownership available for recreational opportunities. And you look at the places where people go to vacation, northern Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Rocky Mountains, that percentage is much higher. Our neighboring states to the north, you know, it's more like 20-25% of their land base is available for public use. And that's why people go there, to get away from it all.
Tom.
Yeah, I want to add to that about the buying the lands and everything. And there is some money available for that, not enough. But you also need to keep in mind that we need to maintain that property once it's bought. It used to be that buying was enough by itself, but anymore we have so much problem with non-native invasive species that create real problems in the natural areas, and it does take some additional monies to maintain those properties once we get them, too.
We are talking about conservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Cliff, this raises the question, and we'll get this started, but I think it's going to be a more prolonged discussion. Whose responsibility should conservation be? I mean, we see some government initiatives here, but obviously there are private organizations who also take on that responsibility. Whose responsibility should it be?
You know, I think that's a great question, and I think at some point everybody in Indiana can play a role. You know, again, I work at the Central Indiana Land Trust, so we're a private, not-for-profit organization that's membership-supported. So we have hundreds of members throughout Central Indiana that give us financial support, and every one of those folks have decided that it's important to them. And there's about 24 land trusts across the state, and groups like the Nature Conservancy, which is statewide, that's doing everything they can every day to protect and, like Tom said, continue to manage these sites into the future.
John, who do you think responsibility?
I agree with Cliff. It's our responsibility as Hoosiers. And, you know, one of the issues has always been that you ask people, you know, is it worth a little bit of their hard-earned money to have clean water and clean air in the state of Indiana? And the answer is always yes. But when it comes time to actually allocating those funds to support the state, it doesn't happen. And it's a little bit of a disconnect that the environment's important to everybody, but it's not what they vote on, unfortunately.
We are talking about conservation. I want to pick up on that point a little more about that disconnect. We're talking about conservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Cliff Chapman, John Shuey, and Tom Homan. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about conservation in Indiana today on No Limits. My guests are Cliff Chapman, who's the executive director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, John Shuey, who's Indiana's director of science for the Nature Conservancy, and Tom Homan, who is past president of INPAWS, that's Indiana Native Plant and Wildflower Society. Just before we went to the break, we were talking about this kind of disconnect. People say they value preserving the environment, conservation values, but then, when it hits the political process, we don't see those values necessarily translated into public policy. Why is that, Cliff?
You know, I think when it comes time to vote, people are oftentimes are thinking about economics. You know, how we're doing that way, but. I think one of the disconnects with conservation for a state like Indiana is I really do believe, and I think it's pretty well documented, that if we do a better job at land conservation, air and water quality, it's going to have those economic benefits. So it really does make sense, but there is a little bit of a disconnect that people seem to see them as two different things, but they're really, it's great for business in Indiana to have more natural areas protected.
We are talking about conservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Miles, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Went to Earth Day downtown Indianapolis, and I talked to the people at the, I think it was the Indiana Forest Alliance, and they were talking about how they're, I think it was through Mitch Daniels, they started allowing to deforest the state parks, and how they're allowing timber to be removed from those parks. And I was wondering how that affects conservation.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Miles. I'll throw that one first to John.
Sure, and there's a little bit of misinformation there that the state parks aren't being harvested for forest products. What happened under Mitch was the actual state forests, which are working lands, the harvest rate was upped to a level that started to approach the growth rate of the forest. So before the level was increased, essentially our forests were growing much faster than they were being harvested on state forest lands. And so that was moved to kind of even it out a little bit, in part to generate more revenue initially used to buy more land for state forests, which was very nice. But then through the annual reductions in Department of Natural Resource budgets that ended up not buying more land here recently. But the reality is our forests, they provide jobs and important to our economy. And given that our state forest lands really have to pay their own way, it's as long as it's managed well. And I'll point out that our state's forests are managed under a third-party certification process, FSC, if I can remember what that stands for.
That's the problem with acronyms. We get lost. we get lost in them sometimes.
Forest something certification. But basically, a global party evaluates how our forests are managed, and every 2 years, the state forest properties undergo a thorough review with the chance for public comment and the like. And the idea is that through every 2 year cycle, the management of those properties gets better and better while still generating jobs in the timber industry and the furniture industry and so on, contributing to the economy.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Shannon via Twitter, and if you'd like to reach out to us, send us a tweet, you can do so at WFYI. Shannon's question is, we hear a lot about air quality in Indiana, certainly focused on citizens, but can we assume that it also affects our flora and fauna? Tom, I think that one's aimed at you.
Oh, absolutely. Taking it away from Indiana a little bit, I spend a lot of time down in the Smoky Mountains area, go down there at least once a year, and that area's been hit by a lot of environmental problems, some of them caused by bad air quality, but a lot of invasive insects and different things too. So that's a place where you can see the effects very well. But certainly the environment, both the clean air and the water and everything, is critical for the well-being of those natural areas.
We are talking about conservation here on No Limits. Art, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi.
Hi. What's on your mind? Oops. Looks like we lost Art. Paige, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks. I wanted to address a little bit what you mentioned about whose responsibility is it for conservation. I think it's everyone's, as your panelist said, and I wanted to call attention to a project up in the St. Joseph County area, LaPorte County area, where the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi, which is a Native American government, has taken 2,000 acres of land and turned it into a NRCS project of restoring kind of like the Kankakee Marsh, plugging ditches, restoring wetlands, planting native grasses, doing some controlled burns, and trying to broadcast wild rice in this area. And so it's a great example of multi-government partnerships and an important aspect of restoring and conserving, you know, the native landscape.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment, Paige. Well, are there other partnership opportunities like that that we should be exploring? Cliff?
You know, I'm sure there are. I would love for someone to approach us here in central Indiana with an opportunity like that to restore 2,000 or 10,000 acres. We don't have any on the cooker right now.
Well, one of the things, to sort of address Paige's larger question or jump-off point, that whole question of responsibility, you know, to some degree, I guess what I was trying to get at is, in most senses, when we say something is everyone's responsibility, we end up really saying it's no one's specific responsibility. Are we doing a good job in terms of saying, you know, someone has to keep an eye on this, make sure that that 3 or 4% that John mentioned, which is already low, does not sink down to 1 or 2, or that at the very least we make some restrictions in terms of what people can do with their privately owned land? John?
Sure. You know, there are groups that have stepped forward, and just like the example with the Potawatomi, you know, that there are groups that want to do conservation, and there's a pretty good environment in Indiana to empower those groups through foundations and grants and things like that. And so that there is a lot of leadership. What we see in Indiana is a lot of conservation isn't the result of one organization going out and kind of pushing it forward. It's a huge partnership. Good example is reforestation along the Wabash River in the southwestern corner of the state, where really the Natural Resource Conservation Service, through a wetland reserve program that they had, has reforested almost 30,000 acres of floodplain habitat that floods regularly but had been turned into row crop. Since then, the Conservancy, partnering with Department of Natural Resources, has moved almost 10,000 of those acres into public ownership, open for hunting and the like. And what's really interesting is a recent study from Notre Dame indicates that those reforested acres are removing about 7% of the nitrogen that leaves the state of Indiana and heads to the Gulf of Mexico and causes that hypoxic zone of no oxygen down in the Gulf of Mexico. And by reforesting a major part of the Wabash floodplain, if we can continue to do that, we could possibly remove most of Indiana's contribution to that national problem, far removed from Indiana.
We're talking about conservation here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Art, welcome back.
Yes, I'm back. Several interesting tidbits. In the 1930s, Indiana was considered the walnut capital of the world. Between the Civil War and the mid-30s, 77 trillion board feet of hardwood lumber was harvested from the state of Indiana. The average height to the first limb of a tree was 94 feet, if you can imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
This is all from a book in the Indiana State Museum that I did volunteer work. I read and took notes on.
Mm-hmm.
And that Shade State Park got its name because the density of the trees was so thick that no light came through. And when women wanted to do their wash back in those days, they went out to the very center of the stream because perhaps once in a while they could get some sunlight and alleviate their sad depression, which they didn't know what it was called back in those days. So to me, the beauty of true virginal wildness is an essential part of our heritage.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing the stories, Art. Thank you. So real quickly, I mean, we're talking about, you know, a heritage there that, you know, 1930s to a lot of people sounds like a long time ago. But in fact, you know, in terms of the history of the world and the environment, it really is close to the blink of an eye. And we're, you know, what have we done in the interim here to present such threats? I'm going to give each of you a crack at that, but I'm going to start with John.
Sure. You know, the reality is that the state's always changing. And, you know, if you look at forest cover in the southern Indiana, it's actually much increased today relative to what it was during the 30s. Our national forest is actually a product of, you know, people abandoning land they were trying to farm down in southern Indiana, which wasn't suitable for agriculture, and simply through a lot of taxes and auctions that ended up in federal ownership. And, you know, that land wasn't forest at the time. And I think we have to realize that the future of conservation isn't to take pieces of land and wrap it up in cellophane and hope that it stays just the same as it always has been, because it's not the same today as it was.
Yeah, growth is a part of nature too.
Exactly,
and change is part of nature. But you know, this whole idea, the concept itself, is a relatively new one historically. I mean, conservation itself as a word, really, at least in the environmental context, didn't exist until about a century ago, right? With Theodore Roosevelt and the development of the beginning of the environmental movement, Tom.
Well, in Indiana, like John was saying, Indiana at one point in time was pretty impoverished as far as natural areas because of all the clearing and everything and widespread farming. I've actually seen aerial photos of Morgan County taken in the 30s, I think it was, where you could hardly see a tree in the whole county. I mean, I'm sure there were a few, but it just was bare land, and look at it today with the woods. So we've come a long way in that. But I think, again, I'll go back to something, I expand on what I said earlier about the need for people to take individual ownership of this and bring it into their own neighborhoods and their own yards. NPAWS is actually constantly encouraging people to plant native plants, because the plants basically are the basis of the food chain. And there's a great book by Doug Tallamy, an entomologist from University of Delaware, that talks about this and how what people plant in their own yards can foster the insect life that supports the bird life and everything, and really have an impact beyond your own yard. And then there's other, if you can do something as a neighborhood association, it's even better. But each person can be part of this solution. It doesn't have to depend on government or these great land trusts that we have here.
Cliff.
You know, and following up on what John and Thomas said, to me, nature in Indiana is quite resilient to have to have all that we have today with the history so much has regrown in places like Brown County and Morgan County. But something that really strikes me is we manage, the Central Indiana Land Trust manages a private forest that's an old growth forest. So it's a piece of forest that's been natural for thousands of years. I mean, it hasn't been converted by man since the glaciers left thousands of years ago. And there's a lot of old growth oak trees that are 350 plus years old. And there's a declining bird species that is in steep decline lately that's very oak dependent, the red-headed woodpecker, just a gorgeous bird. Well, you go out there and there's like three pairs of these red-headed woodpeckers nesting in this fairly small woods. There's not a woodlot near it where they would have migrated into because these are permanent residents. So the idea to think that these species that when we go out and experience this natural moment, these species are literally have been there for generations, for thousands of years. It's really incredible to think about when you get out there.
We are talking about conservation here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Gary did and find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Gary's got a specific question. He says, what ideas or plans are being generated about the areas similar to the coal or gas property near Pleasant Run, Keystone, and Prospect Streets? Does anyone have any idea? So let me broaden that then. What are, in terms of you know, on one side we can say industrial sites that have been abandoned. The other thing is, say they're being repurposed. Are there ways that we can repurpose those that allow us to preserve natural resources, John?
Sure, and I can speak to Southwest Indiana, where you know there are the massive coal mines that have been reclaimed, and some of our best grassland bird populations are on those coal mines, and they're not exactly natural areas. And other than the birds, there's not a lot of that intrinsic beauty there, but they are amazing for the number of rare and declining birds like Henslow sparrow, grasshopper sparrow, and things like that. So those tracts of lands can be restored, and you can be very creative on how you create amenities out of those.
Is there anybody out there, I mean, who focuses on trying to turn those areas around, Cliff?
You know, and there's some examples in other cities like Baltimore that's taken, sites called brownfields, former environmental, have had some soil issues from past industry and turned them into green space, not necessarily what we'd call a natural area, but definitely green kind of park space. So there are examples across the country of how that's worked. And, you know, from another kind of large example down in southeast Indiana, the old Jefferson Proving Ground, where literally there was bombs going off and were retested for World War II and Vietnam Wars with mortars and bombings. Now that that's been kind of let go to nature, it's another site that's just fantastic for grassland species.
Is that an opportunity? Because we do see an awful lot of, if not industrial, we also see places like, you know, strip malls pop up and then they seem to get abandoned. There's a relatively short cycle. Are there things we can do there to sort of reclaim that space, Tom?
Well, certainly there's a lot of potential there. The problem is it's not going to be a true natural area in the sense of the pristine areas that have been untouched. Nature will do amazing things to heal itself, but it takes time for nature. And most people tend to not be that patient. That's a difficulty. If you're wanting that instant rehab, then
gratification.
Gratification. And that's probably why we mostly, more often when we do restore those areas, we do it as a prairie, which may not have been natural to this area, but it takes so long for the trees to grow.
And is that one of the challenges that you find in terms of motivating people to deal with, accept responsibility for conservation, is the fact that on some of this stuff, the impact isn't going to be immediate. You may be doing things that are going to benefit people three or four generations from now, but not necessarily now. Cliff, you're nodding your head.
I'll tell you, I mean, John, that gets me really excited because my wife and I have a 4-month-old son at home, and we're doing restorations here in Central Indiana planting trees, and they're going to grow up with him.
We are talking about conservation here in Indiana. My guests are Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, John Shuey, who's Indiana's Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy, and Tom Homan of NPAWS. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about conservation in Indiana. My guests are Cliff Chapman, who's the executive director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, John Shuey, who's Indiana's director of science for the Nature Conservancy, and Tom Homan, who is past president of INPAWS, that's Indiana Native Plant and Wildflower Society. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Morton who says, these are wonderful groups, yet I wonder what is the relationship between the Central Indiana Land Trust, Sycamore Land Trust, that's Bloomington and South, and the Nature Conservancy, and then the National Nature Conservancy. Are they competing for the same money? How do they work together? Well, I think Tom's going to sit this one out, and we'll let you two talk. We'll start with Cliff.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and working in Indiana with very limited resources, the different conservation groups across the state very often partner together. We're stronger working together than competing against each other. I'm also the president of the Indiana Land Protection Alliance, which is a coalition of all the land trusts in Indiana, and there's about 24, and we work together to help each other achieve all of our individual missions, and often they're in geographies that don't overlap. And with the Nature Conservancy, we're doing several deals together right now to protect some fantastic natural areas.
John, you want to weigh in?
Sure, and I'd build on that, you know, together we're synergistically stronger than we are as separate entities. And as far as competing for funding and the like, yeah, no doubt there's a little bit of competition, but I think each of the land trusts has its own geography and its own donor base. The Conservancy often raises money outside of Indiana to bring in, and grants and the like. And like I said, together we raise more money than individually if we were all just kind of fighting each other.
We've gotten an email question from another listener that sort of tracks on that and says, I'm gonna boil it down because it's a little long and complicated. Would it be better to have, instead of 24 land trusts, just one? You know, is there some duplication or redundancy there, especially since there never seems to be enough money to go around for all the things you want to do? Cliff.
Sure. You know, there's some very small land trusts, or I shouldn't say small land trusts, but there's land trusts in northern Indiana that work in very small geographies, like the watershed of one lake, mm-hmm. In the Lake District of northeastern Indiana. And, you know, if there was one bigger body, it might have to prioritize things in a different way, where in that case, there's some local groups, and there's actually several that work with some of those lake watersheds are really big up there. And that's their only focus. And so I think if you lose that organization, you would lose that conservation that's happening in that local area.
So it gives you an opportunity, having the different ones, to brighten the corner where you are in mm-hmm. the focus. Yeah, Tom.
Yeah, I just want to touch on that from the different standpoint, the standpoint of the donor and volunteer myself, which I donate to both of these organizations. Mm-hmm. And the I like what the TNC stands for and a lot of the things they do, and appreciate that. Central Indiana Land Trust is a more local emphasis, and it gives me more opportunities to volunteer and to go out there and actually do some work on the properties. So it's a different focus with the different groups, and something that a volunteer or a donor can appreciate of both of them.
We have gotten a question from a listener named Michael via Facebook, and if you'd like to reach out to us on Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Michael says, sadly, the politicians in this state are owned by the corporations who make lots of money from destroying the environment, and trees don't have lobbyists, so they get cut down. Too many people are hopelessly disconnected from the natural world and have no clue that their very lives depend on protecting and conserving the water and land. Cliff, you're chuckling.
Well, You know, I guess as executive director of a land trust, I have to be an optimist, and I have a different world view. There's certainly problems out there, but I think we have to, you know, I think this very show, just if more folks care about nature, care about natural areas here in Indiana, then, you know, it's the people that vote for elected officials. And if they let their elected officials know this is important to them, then we can start getting some traction.
The stereotype is that you get to either vote for jobs or for, you know, some rare and relatively esoteric species that might be threatened by cutting down trees. And the names for many conservationists and environmentalists are derogatory. you know, the perception. Is it a false choice to say, though, that preservation and development are necessarily opposing forces, John?
You know, I'll say it's very much a false dichotomy. That there was just a Kinsey report of CEOs across the U.S., I think over 2,000 CEOs of major companies. 50% of those CEOs said that sustainability was a major part of their job, and 13% that's their primary focus. And the issue is they don't quite understand what sustainability is at the moment, but corporations are starting to understand that the old days of, 1950s industrialism are over, and that you can't simply exploit natural resources in the name of profit, that you have to start looking out into the future and understanding what will maintain your corporation. And granted, they're still thinking about their bottom line, but they're starting to ask for
help.
In
a more sophisticated way. And I guess, Cliff, I'll throw that one in, Tom, as well. I mean, that sustainability, that's another one of those terms that's of relatively recent vintage. That's not something you would have heard in boardrooms in the 1970s. For example, does that the whole concept and the fact that we are discussing that have the potential to be a game changer in terms of the way we look at preserving resources?
You know, I think very quietly the game is starting to change already, and we have a past board president who was a real estate developer. These aren't opposing forces. Folks that are out there wanting to see more development, more growth. Having sustainable natural resources alongside with that is going to help. It's going to help on both sides of the equation.
We are talking about conservation here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call. Been listening to the conversation, really enjoying it, and everybody's making great points, but I am concerned, what are the implications for people's private property rights?
In terms of conservation?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call and the question. I'll let everyone take a crack at that. Start with you, Cliff.
Sure. Everything that we do with land protection, land conservation, is with willing landowners. And the scenario does not work that I pick up the phone, call somebody, and say, hey, I want to buy your land. It takes several years to work with and build relationships and trust with these folks. And there has, with whether we're talking about the state of Indiana or private land trusts, we only work with willing sellers.
Well, let me take that a little further, though. I mean, I think Tom was asking a question more. At what point, even if it is private property, do we as a society have the right to say, you know, no, there are some things you can't do with your private property. If you live upstream, you can't pollute and make everyone else who has property downstream suffer. John, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I was nodding my head in a little bit in confusion, but you know, with certain there are regulators, and they're somewhat separate from conservation. And the regulators are the Environmental Protection Agency, and then they're kind of state arms, which is Indiana Department of Environmental Management. And, you know, they do have those rights to basically look out for the public good from private impacts to resources. But conservation, like Cliff said, you know, when we move land into conservation ownership, it's a years-long conversation that happens, and it's with willing sellers, and the, you know, it's always a market price for the land, and we're very patient, essentially, because you have to be when most of the state is in public ownership. And I should say that the Conservancy has, you know, a fairly small footprint that we really want the Conservancy to own and manage. And it's most of the landowners within the footprint are well aware that we'd love to own their land. And when they're done with it, hopefully they'll offer it up to us.
How do you determine, you say it's always at market price, how do you determine that market price? I mean, normally the way you do that is you put it up and the person who's willing to pay the most gets it. Cliff.
Yeah, we work with certified appraisers, licensed appraisers, and the land conservation movement really uses all the same tools and that any like developer would. We use the best appraisers that are out there, the best land surveyors, environmental consulting companies to make sure that we're not taking on risk when we buy a parcel of land.
That you have there ever been instances when you've paid too much for a piece of land or found out that you made a mistake?
No, we actually by policy we cannot pay more than appraised value for land.
Oh, so it but that still puts you dependent upon the appraisal, right?
Absolutely, we have to trust them. They're the professionals that that's their expertise.
Well, I want to take this back to the sort of the larger question. Here, we've sort of established that it is, to some degree, everyone's responsibility. And before we went to the break, Cliff was talking movingly about the fact that he's got a four-month-old child and that a lot of what's being preserved is and reclaimed to some degree is going to do so, you know, at the same time that his child is growing up. What are some of the ways that we can impress upon young people the importance of conversation, starting with children? Tom.
Well, I'm going to sound like a broken record here in a sense, go back to some of my earlier preaching about bringing nature back into your neighborhoods and yards. If you don't have the time or with all the between your kids' time, with all the organized activities and stuff to get them out into a park and everything, ideally get them out into some parks and things. But if you don't have that time to take your kid into nature, bring nature into your yard. Give them something interesting to look at. Rather than a sterile garden of flowers that are pretty in color but have no insect life or butterflies or things around them, bring something in there that's going to have that full cycle of things and give them something to go out there and get outside and see.
What's an example, Tom?
Well, best example is a typical one that many people have heard a lot about, the monarch butterfly. Everybody loves the monarch butterflies and monarch in particular, but the monarch butterfly needs milkweed plants for the larva to feed on. And without those milkweed plants, you won't see any monarch butterflies. So I've heard people complain that about they have this beautiful garden and they seldom see butterflies. Well, again, it's because you need those native plants to nourish the larva and see those butterflies.
Cliff.
You know, I sometimes talk about our trilliums here in central Indiana and our woods being the gateway flower. You know, it's the one that when somebody sees their first trillium, which is not something that would just kind of grow wild in their backyard or something, you actually have to get to a forest to see it. And when kids or maybe even adults sometimes see their very first trillium in the woods, oftentimes it's what gets them hooked. And they're like, oh, my God, I had no idea there were flowers that are just growing wild in Indiana this beautiful.
Actually, Jack of the Pulpit is what did it for me.
sure. And, you know, this question actually gets at the difference between the Nature Conservancy and the local land trust, where we often have a kind of a global vision and very strategic across the state and where we are interested in performing conservation. But the role the local land trust play, it's more in your backyard. And And children today, you know, they need a place that they can see nature. And that's what the local land trusts do. And, you know, I tell people that, you know, the world would be a terrible place if the Nature Conservancy succeeded perfectly at achieving our mission and nothing else got conserved, because, you know, it could be an hour and a half drive for people to experience nature. And that's what needs to happen.
I've gotten an email question from a listener named Ruth, who says, we as a state have the responsibility to care for our natural heritage. Unfortunately, funding from the state government through DNR to our state parks, for instance, has declined remarkably in recent years. Please speak to this. Tom.
I couldn't agree more. I've seen it.
She teed one up for you there, Tom.
Yeah,
supposed
yeah.
to swing.
I'll be honest. I used to work for the Department of Natural Resources. I'm retired now.
Okay.
And so I know firsthand what's happened, and the funding level, just like I think John referred to earlier, 5% each. 5% is not a huge amount, but when you do it every single year or biennium, it just they're looking at cutting positions now again. There was a number of retirements. They're talking about not filling a lot of those. Our state park system is not funded to where it can be a sustainable funding.
Okay. We've also got another email question. It says, please speak to the loss to the natural environment if the White River were to be dammed at Anderson, Indiana. John?
Sure. The Conservancy hasn't taken an official position on this, but we're drafting one. And it's going to be that the loss of a river and turning it into an artificial reservoir is not a positive thing. Right now, you know, that project's being justified in part with drinking water concerns, and yet the state is in the beginning stages of actually strategically planning for water needs in the future. And we'd prefer if there's something as drastic as building a reservoir on the White River, that it be performed within context of a statewide plan, not on the basis of a local initiative, if you will.
Tom.
Yes, that proposed reservoir would actually flood in total a dedicated state nature preserve and flood a third of Mound State Park. And I've just been amazed at how that's some people look at that and say, yeah, well, whatever. And that gets back to the lack of a conservation ethic. Now, many other people are upset about it, but at the same time, it's being pushed as a need for water. The Citizens Energy has done their projections for the next 30 or 40 years and say they don't need it for that time period. So it would do horrible damage to not just in the park, but forested areas along the river. It would just be a catastrophe.
I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank all of you. Cliff Chapman, who is the Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust, thanks for being in here, Cliff. Enjoyed talking with you. Good luck with your four-month-old.
Thank
you. Hope you're sleeping through the night now. John Shuey, who is Indiana's Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy. John, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And Tom Homan, who is the past president of INPAWS, that's the Indiana Native Plant and Wildflower Society. Tom, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.